I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. John McLaughlin Gray joins me again. The distinguished playwright and novelist discusses the latest in his Rain Coast Noir series of books set in Vancouver in the 1920s. Mr. Good Evening begins with a gruesome murder. Dora Decker is accused of stabbing her stockbroker employer to death 25 times with a high-heeled shoe. The book evokes the press of the day so well as newspapers shape and influence public opinion as a sensational murder case makes the news. Decker is arrested, and details of her, her employer, the murder itself, are plastered on newspapers not just here, but around the world. The media itself is evolving as the book begins, as the advent of radio ushers in a new way to communicate, not to mention capture the public's imagination. Ed McCurdy, a former muckraking journalist, is lured to the airwaves, becoming one of the first radio personalities, not just in Vancouver, but across Canada. His nightly broadcasts make him a draw for audiences and possibly a target of murder. Inspector Calvin Hook is another character who pieces together the mystery of the murder at the start of the book to the wet, boozy streets of 1920s Vancouver being somehow connected to Al Capone, Churchill, and a mystical cult on De Courcy Island. And it's not a stretch, considering that there was a cult at that time on that island. I'll get Mr. Gray, who joined me earlier this month, to tell us as much as he'd like about this book, the characters, and the Vancouver that all of this is set in. It's such an eventful period in Vancouver's history, and great inspiration for this book and the previous two, 2021's Vile Spirits and 2017's The White Angel, which he first appeared on the program with. John McLaughlin Gray is a writer, composer, performer for stage, film, television, radio, and print. He is best known for his stage musicals, including the phenomenal Billy Bishop Goes to War. He is the recipient of the Governor General's Medal and is an officer of the Order of Canada. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, John McLaughlin Gray. Mr. Gray, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for joining us. So this is the third in a series that you've called Rain Coast Noir. For people listening, they need not have read the first two books, but if they're compelled to go out and buy them, what might they expect in the other two?
Well, in the three novels are set in 1924, 1929, and 1934, and The White Angel is dominated, of course, by guys coming back from the First World War. That's really the dominating factor. Plus, as usual, things that are going on in the States. 1929. It's set before the crash.
Yeah.
And it has to do with liquor, with the corruption built around the liquor industry, as well as these trends coming up from the States, especially the Ku Klux Klan, which was a sort of an Amway type operation. It wasn't anything like during Reconstruction. It was basically, it was founded by the Southern Publicity Association, and they used all the names, the Clictons and the Clactons and the this and that, the whole thing. But they sent guys to various communities, identified who they hated, and became gathered members for piles of dough. And they kept doing it until they ran out of new members, and then moved on. And it depended what they were against. Well, in Vancouver, of course, it was the Chinese.
Yeah.
In Saskatchewan, it was the Ukrainians. And it was the Catholics, and so on and so forth.
And so this takes us to Mr. Good Evening, which is I'm about a third of the way through, and I'm enjoying it a great deal. It begins with a very gruesome murder, that of Ralph Tucker. Who was he?
Well, the House Street was always a den of iniquity. Halstrup was always full of very sketchy, dodgy operators. It was intended, the Vancouver Stock Exchange was intended to kind of round up all these fly-by-night guys and put them, and all they did was give them legitimacy. So it was just a hive of especially money laundering and stuff. And what interests me in all three books is how world events play themselves out in this colonial backwater, yeah. Really, you know, at the edge of the empire. And in this case, it played itself out in, as which is what I like, in really kind of weird ways, you know?
Yeah.
The connections between the, and I 34 was the year Churchill came to town, and the year the Vancouver, the PNE type thing, the big
fair,
burnt down.
Yeah.
And things. And it's also involves international money laundering. It's what? Do you know that? Yeah, because I loved the way the term money laundering came from the fact that the first money launderers were, in fact, laundries, because they were cash operations.
Yeah.
And this sort of started me off on that. And it was also, of course, Brother 12 was at his... at his nadir, or his height, whichever you want to say,
yeah.
And his trials were happening. And Brother 12 was a fake mystic who gathered a very devoted crowd of people on De Courcy Island, and ran his own little feudal fiefdom.
Yeah.
So, there.
So you take us to De Courcy Island in Mr. Good Evening.
Yeah.
He's not named Brother 12, but it's a similar story, right?
Oh, yeah. I use Brother 12, but I only use, you know, I only use what serves the plot.
Yeah.
Then I change the name.
So this is, for all intents and purposes, I guess, a cult. And what's fascinating is I'm reading Mr. Good Evening, and you're describing the people that end up in De Courcy Island, which is just near Nanaimo there.
Yeah.
These are not, I don't know how to describe these people. These aren't poor people looking for something. These are generally well-heeled people, right?
Oh, yeah. Because of the whole, anthroposophy movement and these mystical movements were afoot everywhere. They'd been afoot really since the First World War, you know, because all the ghosts and stuff. But the things, and it was also 1934. My main character, who was a sort of a journalist, I don't know, I should call him a journalist, sort of Mike Rehan, he becomes Canada's first radio personality, coast to coast. And this guy really existed, and his name was Mr. Good Evening. And he never named himself. The people of Canada named him that. And it went coast to coast simply because it went from the newspaper to recorded on the newspaper, and by wire went to the CNR. And it went on trains all across Canada. And from the stations, it went off into various communities and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Radio itself at the time was a quasi-mystical medium. Mm. I mean, the first people who discovered the radio waves thought you could communicate with the dead.
Yeah.
You know? And for somebody... I use a quote by E.B. White that for somebody in, for example, Gravelburg, Saskatchewan, listening to the radio, that wasn't the voice of a man in the studio. That was the voice of God.
Mm. Yeah. So this is why the Aquarians of DeCourcy, I guess. This is why they turned to that, because it, as you set up in the book, you know, this is the end of these folks have survived the Great War, the Spanish flu.
Yeah.
They're looking for something to believe and rely on, and religion, as Christianity as they've known it, doesn't really suit them, I suppose, and logic and science has sort of failed them.
Yeah.
They believe in the sort of mysticism, don't they?
Well, they want to believe in it.
Yeah.
And that's the key. That's the key to a con game, is people have to want to believe it. I mean, that's Donald Trump for you. If people who want to believe Donald Trump will never stop believing Donald Trump.
Yeah. And so these are folks that are, you know, have made a lot of money and the sort, and they give it all up, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. To an incredible extent, and they accepted the most outlandish sort of deviations on his part.
Yeah.
From, I mean, he had a kind of harem going. His wife was there, but he also had a second that he person that he put the. He claimed that they were in a previous life. They had been two Egyptian goddesses and goddesses. And
yeah.
They met on the train from Chicago. I mean, it's and that was accepted. It was what people actually kind of bought, and the lengths that they would go. I mean, it became quite brutal. The Brother 12 thing. People were kind of quasi starved and nearly and worked and were kicked off the island with nothing, you know, and it was pretty brutal towards the end. Yeah, and they were and then there was the wonderful trials, and what I love about trials, it's like the trial in the White Angel. The inquest in the White Angel. I don't have to make up anything.
Yeah,
it's all one of those things where if I made that up, I would be a surrealist.
So I mentioned this murder at the beginning of the book, and what's fascinating is how the media covers it. I mean, it's a sensational murder case because it's pretty bloody, and the press drives that.
Yeah.
And then we see the influence of newspapers in shaping public opinion. And then when radio comes to town, as it does in the late 20s, you know, it's seen as a way to sell advertising as well as develop a sort of, a buffer towards the American influence.
Yeah.
But it does take on a life of its own, doesn't it? And even though they predict the death of newspapers, the two of them sort of work on parallel tracks, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It's a little like they're always predicting the death of print.
Yeah.
You know, when the telegraph was came out, people thought everyone would have a telegraph in their house and they wouldn't need newspapers anymore. That's always kind of the thing.
Yeah, and so this character of Ed McCurdy, a reporter who wrote on the Evening Star, and makes his way to radio.
Yeah.
On radio, though, he's not a journalist per se. He's just a presenter of the news, isn't he?
He's a presenter of the news, and I used the original Mr. Good Evening. I mean, he was. I have trouble coming up with names immediately like that. Anyway. He was an Australian who worked for the Vancouver Province.
Uh-huh.
It was just basically the same situation. And he happened to have a particular voice. And at that particular time, you know, it's hard to think back at a time where nobody heard their own voice.
Yeah.
How are you going to do that? You know? And so he discovers that he has a voice that is good for radio.
Yeah, and yet at the same time he's still interested in finding out, I guess doing the muckraking, isn't he?
He is because he's got a lot of time on his hands to begin with. He's 15 minutes every night, and he reads up to 90 items in that time. and it comes straight off the wires. And he's got this time, and he's got this whole situation here, and you can't help but sort of put together some of the stuff you read in the news. And,
yeah.
And also, he's being attacked. I mean, some unknown person is after him. And he doesn't know why he's being, but he's being threatened.
And he's getting letters from people.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And someone's after him. Now he has he's living at the Quadra Club, which was one down from the Vancouver Club, big step down, but it was. It had a bar and it had a concierge. And this, I put a guy in there who was a boxer, George Paris, had been a boxer, and he was also been a drummer. He managed. This is a guy who eventually ran. He taught self defense for the Vancouver Police Force.
Mm.
And he's a fascinating character because he's a jazz drummer and he's a boxer,
yeah.
You know? And he's black.
Yeah.
Right. And so it gets me into the different languages people speak. Like the Chinese, for example, who, don't let on that they can speak as much English as they can. The blacks like most minority groups have two languages. They one that they use in public, and that they have one that they use between themselves. And that's a real nice way to kind of talk about language, you know. Because Zora Neale Thurston was a marvelous black writer who created this whole lexicon. And I couldn't resist it.
Yeah, and so what is it like for you, John, to because you have such an ear for dialogue in everything that you've written, figure out how people spoke when there are no recordings. I mean, do you get a lot of that a lot of that flavor, say, from the newspapers of the era?
Well, I got a lot of it from actually. I used to play with a soul music band in Nova Scotia. We played Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett and stuff. And there was a group that we used to kind of, from Toronto, we used to see and we'd hang out with when they played in Halifax. And this was Eric Mercury and the Soul Brothers. And we were in that group, they talked a completely different language. And you had to get the rhythm. And once you get the rhythm, you can do it. You know?
Yeah.
That one of them was, you know, I can remember Smitty, we were going into this hotel, and it was a pretty cheap hotel. And the hotelier said, "You're not going to have another party tonight." And he said, "For $25 motherfucker dollars a week, ain't no motherfucker going to tell me ain't going to be no party." Now, I mean, that's beautiful language in my ear, and you never forget it.
Yeah. Did radio change how people talked in this town?
Oh, sure. It radio, how people talked. It certainly changed. It solidified two languages. One language that we speak out in this to strangers and to clients into this, and one language we speak within a crowd, you know.
Yeah, because I ask that because as you set the scene in all three books about how just how British this town was then. You know, there are Irish and Scottish people as well.
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering what the accents were like in Vancouver 100 years ago.
Oh, well, they were exactly like the accents that the people came with.
Mm.
So if they were from Manchester, they would have Manchester accents. And if they were from London, they would have London accents. And I try to get that in the rhythm of the dialogue so that you can actually kind of hear it. Because the Manchester accent is really quite unique, and I use the Scottish, and I use my policeman's wife. She speaks with a Manchester accent, and it's a way of pointing out that the people here, the diversity of the people who lived here, you know.
Yeah.
It's often very, you have to be really accurate, or try to be very accurate with that kind of language, because, you know, you get accused of racism.
Yeah.
So you really have to be able to say, this is why, yes, this is exactly how people talk then.
Yeah. And as you say at the front of the book, when you do invoke something that might be considered racist, you're only pointing out just how far we've come.
Yeah. It would be so. It would be to boulderize the past,
yeah,
to whitewash the past is a sin.
Yeah. I asked about accents a moment ago because, you know, I follow the news business in this city.
Sure.
And there are a couple of reporters in on television who have strong Australian accents, I've noticed. And the thing I notice on social media,
yeah,
is people point out how they don't like that, which,
yeah,
I find amusing because, I mean, if you go back to Vancouver, as we read in your book 100 years ago, people had very strong accents. You look about 50 years ago, Jack Webster was on the radio with a very thick Scottish accent.
Jock Webster.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know where we just assume that there's a Canadian accent.
Well, Canadians have regional accents.
Yeah.
The general Canadian accent that we think of comes from, of course, Ontario, and it's from Toronto. It's not from Southern Ontario. Jesus, Southern Ontario, oh, Jesus, you're talking like that, you know. You're in Southern Ontario.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the maritime accent's kind of like a drawl. Out here, because it wasn't the settlement was so new,
yeah,
everyone talked in accents you could cut with a knife.
When you look, by the way, you mentioned George Parris a moment ago. When you find a character like that, in the course of your research for,
yeah,
writing these books, and you're obviously captivated by a character like this, that you put him
in your
book.
Well, you know, he was from my hometown. Yeah.
What is it like then? I mean, it just must be exciting as you're sitting at your desk or wherever you are working to find something like this.
Oh, I become a hobbyist. I become like the guy. I find out everything I can about George. It doesn't matter whether it's for the book or not. I just got to know all about this. You know,
yeah,
it liked radio and how radio did this. There's lots that isn't in the book, but the George Parris story, I mean, the guy who, he managed Jack Johnson, for God's sake, who was, you know, Jack Johnson was the black, two whites in the States, was a black beast because he was just an unbeatable fighter.
Yeah.
And he was not the least bit kowtowing to anybody or for anything. You know, Miles Davis did an album called Jack Johnson because he admired him. And once you get into it, and you never know what you can use, you know. There are some times, you know, when you really don't know, you know, so you... There's a way of cheating, which is you show something as though it were the tip of the iceberg, when in fact it's the whole iceberg. And I can admit to doing that often, but mostly I kind of know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So when you look back at the Vancouver of today and that of 100 years ago, which you write about in these books, There are a lot of parallels, aren't there? And we tend to overlook that when we're talking about, say, current events and what's happening in this town today.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, you know, real estate. Just take real estate as being the central focus of Vancouver. That goes right back to the very beginning. Vancouver was never had pioneers. Mm. It was gridded out by the CPR before the first settler got here. And the whole story of Vancouver is a story of real estate. And real estate speculation, the whole thing. And so these ups and downs of real estate, booms and busts and things, and that's been going on actually since Vancouver was pretty much founded. There's an awful lot of things like that in the book that you'll look at it and you go, oh yeah, they do that now, you know.
Exactly, yeah. I've done that a couple times already as I'm reading the book. So knowing as much as you do about the city and the history of this town, I guess nothing shocks you about the progression of Vancouver. I mean, some might use another word than progression, but
yeah.
There's so many similarities that you can't be surprised by what happens, right?
No, not at all. Not at all, especially when the role of sudden a lot of money coming into town for some one reason or another, and the place becomes defined by this. The one thing is that about Vancouver is, of course, that Vancouver was several towns were what we call Vancouver. You know, like Dunbar was a little town.
Right.
So it was Carisdale, and they were connected by the interurban railway, which no person from Vancouver to New Westminster was less than, I guess, a minute and a half from us, from a stop. It was actually a more, for its size, it was a more efficient system than what we have now.
Yeah,
it was, and I kind of delight in that kind of stuff too, of how they did things a little better. But also, my God, the mind-bending corruption of the place. Boy, we can't hold a candle to them for corruption. Within the police, in the organized crime.
Yeah,
the government in vile spirits all about the corruption with the Liquor Control Board, which was an they sold terrible liquor at huge prices, and so the bootleggers, whom it was meant to kind of put out of business, never did better business, you know. I don't know. I don't think we can compare with it for corruption.
Yeah. So this is the third in a series.
Yeah.
Is this the end of that?
Well, it's the end of the Vancouver. I'm thinking about another book that I want to write, but not in Vancouver. I want it to be centered around the Bedeau expedition, which was I'm not going to go into it,
sure,
but bit too much. But it was one of those things. It was not doomed. It was an act of folly, a grotesquely expensive expedition in northern British Columbia that had connections to the Nazis, and it had connections to, you know, and what that was out there and what they encountered, you know.
Yeah.
And talk about languages and stuff. I mean, what if, for example, a person went into the land of the Nahanni, which is a group of nations all up and down the Nass River and these places, and what would happen if a man then who had never had been purely his experience was in Vancouver of Canada, really, found themselves in the middle of the Nahanni, and the Nahanni territory. And what if the world of the Nahanni were literally true, you know? Mm. It's a little like Guillermo del Toro movies, you know?
Yeah.
That you know, the significance of the raven really did play.
Well, to these three books, though, will you miss these characters? Will you miss this era of Vancouver?
Yeah. 1929. I'm sorry. It was 1924, 1925, and this one is 1929. And
yeah.
I'm going to miss Vancouver, right? Because the streets and the places are so. Then are so clear to me now. The jazz clubs, you know, out underneath the bridge, underneath the Georgia Viaduct and Hogan's Alley, the whole and all that, and it, you know, the whole. It's very interesting, the racism question, because it's so selective, and you know. I mean, Vancouver was not anti-Semitic, largely because of the Oppenheimer. The mayor, Oppenheimer, was the most popular mayor in Vancouver history and still stands as it. He created Stanley Park, you know, and there's Oppenheimer Park here.
Mm.
And the blacks, it wasn't particularly, no, it was localized around the railway station, but there wasn't a really active anti-black kind of thing. It was anti-Chinese, anti-Oriental.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That was the case. In fact, the black sections of town, those were really the place to go for the swinging sets and young, you know.
I must have asked you this before, but if I did, I can't remember the answer. Why did you choose to write about Vancouver in the 20s, as opposed to say, well, you came to town when, in the 60s?
Oh, well, I had a really good friend who died a year or so ago named Norman Young.
Oh, yeah.
Who was a Vancouver He was a real compendium of Vancouver holy shit facts.
Yeah, he was at UBC, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was the tech director, but he was way more than that. I mean, he created the Orpheum tour.
Yeah, with Hugh Pickett and
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he got me interested in period Vancouver, and at the time, I thought I was retired when I started writing. Writing The White Angel, I decided I was retired because none of the big publishers were interested in me anymore. And so I was just writing it basically as it to keep the mind, because I like writing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like researching, and Vancouver, it's so handy.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the archives, you know. So I just started burrowing away at it with no intention. As far as I was concerned, I was the old guy in the basement doing with his model train set, you know, making ships in jars or something. And eventually, I had a draft that I'd been fooling with, and I got to a certain point. And so I just I just called up. I didn't call anybody except Howard White at Douglas and McIntyre, and I said, "Could you read this and tell me if you like what you think?" And he said, "Yeah, I like it." And that became something that was going to become a reality outside my own head.
Yeah. What is it like then when you go down House Street today? And I mean, are you seeing the places that you're writing about?
Oh gosh, yes. Oh yeah. It's and through Shaughnessy.
Yeah.
Geez, you know, you can't pass Canuck House in the middle of Shaughnessy without realizing, knowing, once you know that it was the headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan, you can't get that out of your head when you walk by it.
Yeah. I can't tell you. I mean, I'm going to go back and read Vile Spirits again and The White Angel. I'm going to finish this book first. I mean, I just love this period that you're talking about because, in a way, it's familiar. Like when you talk about Mildred's house on Venables.
Yeah.
I see that street.
Yeah. Yep. For someone from Vancouver, you know, the Italian section of Vancouver.
Yeah.
Which was, in fact, the Italian, the Japanese town. The whole, which we still know, you walk down near Oppenheimer Park, and you can walk through Japanese town, and there's nothing left really of it, but you know it when you're walking by because you'll see occasional places that were parked like have a kind of Japanese look.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're not retired, and I look forward to the next book when that comes out. I so appreciate your time. It's been such a pleasure to talk again, John.
Great to talk to you too, Joe. You take care of yourself.
Indeed.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The book is called Mr. Good Evening. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, John McLaughlin Gray, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.